So we're going to be in Daniel 8, but I'd like to take just a minute and explain the handout. the bottom of the outline. Today, we're fascinated with time and calendars, and it's much more important to us today than it was in the past. You know, we've got watches that in a couple of weeks are going to set themselves forward for or backward for daylight savings without our even thinking about it. But there was a time, you know, whenever night you had to go around and set the clocks back, and everybody that was late for church or early for church, you understood that they messed up. But, you know, a sundial was as much as some of these folks had. And calendars, and, you know, when Daniel wrote this a few hundred years before Christ, there was no such thing as B.C. You know, everything was dated from the rule of a king. And so that's why Daniel starts off 7 and 8 in the such and such first or third year of Belshazzar, because that's where they started numbering. And so when you look back at history, some of the numbers don't agree with each other. Somebody has one plan, somebody has another plan. Usher was famous for his work, and a lot of the Bibles will have the dates according to him. But some of those have been proven wrong. But so this little table at the bottom, this is possible timeline. And if you want to argue about a year or two, go ahead. But if you recall in the nation, so when did, if you're just looking at Daniel, the book of Daniel, you really need to go back a little bit and realize that the kingdom of Israel had been divided after Solomon to the northern tribes and the southern tribes. The southern tribes were okay, and then that's okay, but the northern tribes were always bad. And in discipline, God sent the Assyrians in and took them captive. And that's kind of, in my mind, where this whole thing starts. And so I put on the top there the fall of Nineveh, and that the fact that Nineveh had taken the 10 tribes captive about, I said in there, 740 B.C. So they had been under the Assyrian rule for some time when Babylon started coming to the forefront. And, of course, Nineveh was the capital of Assyria, and we're familiar with it mainly from Jonah. But all this had been going on for a couple of hundred years. And then, as Babylon was rising, they defeated the Assyrians and established their dominion about 605 B.C. The conquering armies at that time would use a very unique way of making sure there was no rebellion in the countries that they had captured. They would take the citizens, in this case of Israel, of Judah, back to their homeland, so they couldn't reorganize a revolt or a rebellion in, say, Jerusalem. So the first group of captives that went back to Babylon included Daniel. And so that's where this whole book starts. And remember in chapter 1, the story of him and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then so on. But Daniel lived a long time. And so underneath that, the third line, Daniel was roughly 605 to 530. So a little quick math, and says that's about 75 years. So a lot of things happened during the time that Daniel was in Babylon. If you read world history, you read about a lot of other things going on. But when you read God's history, what is Ingermar called this? The hymn book? Yeah. It's all about God's people. And he doesn't really care. I shouldn't say it that way. But he concentrates on Israel. And Israel is supposed to tell the rest of the world about their great God. And of course they failed to do that. And in fact, they turned to other gods. And we find that's why God allowed nations that were worse than Israel to conquer them. And that was a real puzzle for a lot of the prophets. God, I know we're bad, but these guys are worse. Why are you allowing them to take us? But even though they were the arm of God, as we'll read a little bit later, God would punish them for capturing, doing bad things to Israel. So anyhow, about 600 years before Christ, Daniel comes into the picture. A couple of years later, Ezekiel joins him in Babylon. And then another 10 years, Jerusalem finally falls, and the third group is deported. We can read about that in Jeremiah, but he was not one of the captives. He stayed home. Then Babylon falls to Medo-Persia. We read that with the handwriting on the wall just a few weeks ago. And the king that came in allowed some of the Jews to go back to Judea. And 20 years later, the temple had been restored. Another, Ezra went back, and one of the remnants returning, and then Nehemiah after that. But now we're out of Daniel's lifetime now. We're in like the 400s. Daniel had died maybe 100 years earlier. But the prophecies that we read in Daniel are all going to take place during this time. And so that's why I said that this is a timeline of events after Daniel's time as well as before and during. And of course, one of the kingdoms we read about is Greece. And Alexander came to power about 330 years before Christ. One of the amazing things about how God orchestrates things is that Greece wasn't mean and nasty like the others. They were, but they also had some culture. They were refined. And the Greek language became the language of the world. And 300 years later, when Christ came, the New Testament is all in Greek. And so God was paving the way, you might say, that everybody was able to speak with one another. Now, you might also have had Hebrew or something, Aramaic, something, but because of Alexander's influence in the cultural side of things, the way was paved for the arrival of the Messiah. And then we'll talk about Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus, or however you say it. I just call him A.E. because it's much easier. And we'll get into him. Something that we don't hear a lot about is about 160 years, 65, 70 years before Christ, a man whose nickname was the Hammer, Maccabees, Judas Maccabees. And he had several brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and nephews and nieces. And they organized a revolt and actually restored the temple in Jerusalem, like I say, maybe 165 years before Christ. As Greece was going off of the scene and Rome was coming on. But there was all kinds of civil fighting in around Jerusalem and Israel. And about 63 years before Christ came, Rome put an end to all that by just conquering the whole area. And so that brings us up to the New Testament, and we'll get that some other lesson. On the back is a table. I know that when Ed was here, he left us a table. This one I think is very simple. I saw the English Standard Version of the Bible has, and they do a lot of other things, but this is basically from them. And in the left-hand column, the right-hand, my left-hand, your right, whatever. You hold it this way, it's right. The column that's on this side of the paper, as you're looking at it, shows the divisions and then how they affect each of the four nations. And then, as Ed was maintaining, that the fourth kingdom, although may have started out Rome, really has never ended. the times of the Gentiles will continue until the future. So you can look at that, and like I say, it's very simple, and if you want to change different things, you can. So we started our study in July with an introduction to the book, and as I said, the deportation of the Hebrew young Hebrews. Chapter 2, we read Nebuchadnezzar's vision, which none of his wise men could interpret, but Daniel did, and it was a vision of the four kingdoms that were going to come. And then Ali came, and he was talking about using Nebuchadnezzar's vision to talk about the possibility of visions today. And how many people from the Middle East, where of course all this was happening 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, many Muslims are coming and saying they have seen a vision. And sometimes we're very skeptical about that. But Ali was pointing out that visions have been used by God in the past, and there's nothing really to say that he couldn't do that today. We do have a written word that they didn't have, but don't just discount it because maybe you're uncomfortable with it. So that was very interesting, and he had some very personal experience with that. And then Mike covered the rest of that chapter, and Ed as well, and of course the outline that he left. Sam brought us in and out of the fiery furnace without even getting smoke on our clothes. And in chapter 4, we looked at another of Nebuchadnezzar's visions, which foretold the fact that he was going to go crazy and for 7 years and then come back. And, of course, that all happened. In chapter 5, we've skipped over several years, and it's the end of Belshazzar's reign, because that night at the end of chapter 5, the Medes and the Persians come in, and Daniel reads the handwriting on the wall. And then it's been pointed out the last couple of weeks that the next chapters actually go back before chapter 5, because Daniel says in the first year of Belshazzar, in the third year of Belshazzar. And then in chapter 5, it's later in his reign, and that night his reign ends. So the intervening chapters are out of sequence chronologically. But at the end of the chapter 5, with the handwriting and all, the Medes and the Persians come in, and the next thing you read that Daniel says starts talking about the Gentile nations conquering Israel, conquering first Babylon and then taking over the area. And so you can understand why he inserts that, but then goes back and picks up what happened during the reign of Belshazzar. And so when we get to chapter 7, first year of Belshazzar, chapter 8, the third year. And just remember, chapter 6 and chapter 5 come after those two chapters. It's a little bit confusing, and that's one reason we put it in a table form. So in chapter 8, we find the second of Daniel's visions. And in this vision, he's going to talk more about the two middle kingdoms. So we have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And so he's going to focus on these two middle kingdoms, which is really when he was alive. Remember, he started under Babylon, told Belshazzar, the kingdom's going to be taken from you. He watched the Medes and Persians come in, and now he's going to talk about them and the ones that are going to feed them, the Greeks. So I've told you before, several years ago, when I put together an overview of the book of Daniel, Ingemar would be interested. I thought of catchy, in my opinion, alliterative titles for each of the chapters. And chapter 8, I call it the fierce fiend with future fulfillment. So there you go. Before we read the text, so let's remember what Nebuchadnezzar had said. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar's probably Belshazzar's grandfather. And he says at the end of chapter 4, verses 34, 35, and 37, he had learned that the Most High God is eternal. This is Nebuchadnezzar's own testimony. He had learned that the kingdom of the Most High God is eternal. See, he had been warned that his kingdom would be taken away. He had learned that the nations are nothing before the Most High God. He learned that God's kingdom is a universal kingdom. And it includes not only the earth, but heaven as well. Angels, man, beasts. And then a very important lesson. His power is irresistible and undeniable. Lastly, everything God does is well done and good. This is the testimony of a pagan king of Babylon. But it seems as though he did not commit this to his successors. So we find that a couple of decades later, his grandson, Belshazzar, is throwing a big party, Daniel 5, and then losing his kingdom. So chapter 6 continues those thoughts, but then chapter 7 and 8 go back in history, as we've been talking about. So in chapter 7, we read Daniel's vision corresponding to Nebuchadnezzar's vision in chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar sees the statue and all the metals. Daniel sees all the beasts. And that table will help you understand the correlation between the head of gold and the belly and the thighs and the legs and the different animals that Daniel saw. It had suggested the difference, a worldly perspective of the grandeur of the kingdoms and a heavenly perspective of the ferocity of the kingdoms. And so in chapter 8, we read about Medo-Persia and Greece. So let's look at those first few verses of Daniel chapter 4, or chapter 8 through verse 14. So it's the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar. A vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. Of course, what appeared to him at the first was a couple of chapters earlier when he saw all the beasts. And now he sees in this vision, which is a couple of years later, he was in Shushan, in the palace, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. Then I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there was stood before the river a ram, which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will. Very important phrase relating to all those kingdoms. They did according to their own will and became great. And when I was considering, behold, a great he-goat came from the west, on the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes, almost like a unicorn. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen before the river, and ran unto him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with great anger against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he, that is the he-goat, cast down the ram to the ground and stamped on him. And there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And it came up four notable horns toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east and toward the pleasant land, that is, Israel. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. We'll get to the explanation in just a minute, but now he's looking not only at the little horn that's going to come, but also to the future when the beast and false prophet are in the tribulation. Yea, he magnified himself even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And the host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. And so that's the vision, and now he hears one saint, one separated one, speaking with another separated one, and said unto that certain one who was speaking, how long shall the vision be concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation, to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And the second one said, unto 2,300 years, days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. So now it's the third year of Belshazzar's reign. He would rule several more years before the events in chapter 5, when he'd lose his kingdom to the Medes and Persians. So this is very significant, because Daniel is telling of things that are going to happen a decade or two later. And he reports them with such precision that skeptics jump on this and say, oh, this had to be written later. There's no way that somebody could predict what was going to happen a decade or two from now with such accuracy. Well, no, they're right. It is impossible with man. But nothing's impossible with God. We were looking at in Hebrews in our Wednesday night study. Nothing is impossible with God. I mean, salvation. Yeah, salvation is impossible for us. But fortunately, that's not the right word, is it? But God provided a way and sent his son so that we could be saved. God is not restricted by time. Prophecies like this in Daniel simply bolster our faith in him and encourage us about the fulfillment of events still to come. Sometimes people wonder why we study books like Daniel and the minor prophets, you know, the doom of Nineveh, the fall of this. But there's always a lesson in there for us. And if it's not that God will take care of us, it's that something else. And God's in control. And when we have a picture of such accurate prophecy, we know that when he says it's going to be a shout and a trumpet and we're going to be called to heaven, it's going to happen just like this did. Even though there are scoffers today that say, fairy tale. From our earlier studies, you may remember in the first chapter that was written in Hebrew. It was about Daniel and his friends. And then from chapter 2, verse 4 to here, through 7, it's written in the language that the Babylonians and the Medes and the Persians and the other at the time would have been familiar with, Aramaic. It's a blend of languages that was used in that part of the country. And so in chapters 2 through 7, which deal with the times of the Gentiles, Daniel is writing in a language that they could understand. But now he's going to be talking, zeroing in on Israel. And so now he switches to Hebrew. That would not have been understood by the Babylonians, but they were gone now. And Israel was going back to the land. And God was going to tell Daniel what was going to happen. And so Daniel switches to Hebrews. Daniel is still serving King Belshazzar in Babylon when he has this vision. There are commentators that believe that Daniel actually went to Shushan, but most think it was just a vision. But in the vision, he pictured himself in the palace at Shushan, which is really amazing, because at the time Daniel was writing this, whether he was actually in the place or whether he was back in Babylon, Shushan was just a wide spot in the road. It didn't become the capital of Medo-Persia until years later. And so once again, we see how God looks forward and says, hey, there's the capital. Daniel, look what's going on. So it's just, you know, it'd be like being in New York City a couple hundred years ago and talking about Denver. Yeah. It's incredible the way the Lord reveals these things to us. He says, this is a different vision than the one I had 2 years ago, which we looked at chapter 7. And in this vision, in Babylon, he's traveled 300 miles east into Persia. He was by the river Ulai in the province of Elam and its capital city of Shushan. It's the same Shushan that we read about in Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1, and in Esther chapter 1, verse 2. So at the time, as I mentioned, Daniel was writing, Shushan was essentially insignificant. But starting in verse 3, Daniel describes what he saw. There was a ram standing evidently between him and the river, and the ram had two horns, one bigger than the other. If you look carefully, it says two horns. The two is italicized, which usually means it's not in the original. And in fact, in the original, the word two is not there. But the fact that he talks about the way that he uses the words, it expresses a duality. And then he says the one and then the other. So obviously, there were two horns. He says he watched and the two-horn ram pushed west, north, and south. Remember, he was in the east. He went east to Persia. And so he sees the ram coming west towards Europe, although staying in Asia Minor for what we know today. Nothing could stop him. And as I mentioned, as we were reading, he was doing it according to his will. Then in verse 5, he sees the he-goat charging from the west. So now the two-horned goat has come from the east across, and now in his vision he sees a he-goat coming from the west. We learn later that it's Greece, and Greece is, of course, across the Mediterranean from the Asia Minor area where the ram was. But he sees him charging with a horn like a unicorn. And he moves so fast, it's like he's just flying over the landscape, not even touching the ground. Of course, we're familiar with how fast Alexander's campaign was. Because he had a very, very small army compared to everybody he was fighting against. And yet, his organization and his speed allowed him to defeat even the Persians. His anger was boiling over, and we'll see why later on. But Persia had committed a lot of atrocities, and he was upset, and he let his anger be shown. He stamped the ram into the ground. I like that King James translation. He waxed stronger and stronger, but at his greatest, the single horn was broken, and the four horns grow in its place, spreading out in all four directions in verse number 8. One of the four horns, one of the new four horns, grew a little horn. And it grew stronger towards the south, like Egypt, east, like where the ram had come from, and toward the pleasant land, or Israel. We'll talk more about this little horn when we get to the interpretation, but for now, let's just say it's a picture of A.E., remember, Antiochus Epiphanes? And he foreshadowed the beast, the Antichrist of Revelation, which we'll get to as well. So some of the actions that are described were fulfilled by both the little horn, A.E., and also the beast of Revelation. But some of it applies just to the beast. And that's where all the mix-up comes in interpreting this passage. We'll get back to that when we get to the interpretation. But the main thing to pay attention to here is in verse 11, the daily sacrifice was taken away. When we studied the book of Exodus, we saw where this was instituted. And every day the Israelites were to bring a morning sacrifice and an evening. Well, let me switch. An evening sacrifice and a morning. Remember the Hebrews, evening and morning. And so they would sacrifice in the evening, and then they would sacrifice again in the morning. And they've been doing this for a long time, and the little horn comes and says, no more. You're not going to do it anymore. And so that's what they're talking about when it says, how long is it going to be, there in verse 13, before they restore the daily sacrifice? And then also that the fact that he cast down the temple. And once again, the details are in the interpretation. So in verse 13, Daniel breaks away from the vision that he sees of the ram and the he-goat, and he hears two people talking, two saints talking. The saints are likely angels. Angels that did not fall with Lucifer are saints in the sense that they are separated for God and are holy. Just a couple of pages back in 4:13, I saw in the vision of my head upon my watch, and behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. And there's other examples in the Bible. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12, and the book of Jude, verse 14. So it's evident that these are not human beings in his vision, but they look like men, and he calls them saints or separated ones. So the one angel speaks, and another angel answers to the first one. And it's described here as that certain saint. I heard one saint speaking, one angel speaking, and another angel said unto that certain angel which spoke. So that's an interesting phrase, that certain one. It's a word that's used in Ruth chapter 4, verse 1, about a certain person, and in that case, a kinsman redeemer for Ruth. It's also used in 1 Samuel 21, 3, and 1 Kings 6, 8, in which it's talking about a certain place. And those two ideas seem to be combined. The Greek is P-A-L, pal, moni, M-O-N-I. If Mike were here, he could tell us the correct pronunciation, but that's where we'll leave it. At least one commentator believes that this was his name rather than just a certain one. His name was Palmoni. We know that Gabriel, Michael, Lucifer, nobody believes my Hark the Herald Angel, but that's okay. Palmoni, whether he was his name or whether it was just another term, we don't know. Many believe that this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. But usually when he comes in the Old Testament, he's called the angel of the Lord, not just a certain one. So who exactly they were is debatable, but their conversation is written down for us. We can't debate it. How long will it be until the daily sacrifice and the sanctuary are restored? And notice this, when he answered, he didn't answer the angel that asked the question. He answered Daniel. He said unto me. So Daniel was very curious, and I think the conversation between the two angels was based on the fact they knew that Daniel had some questions. The sanctuary will not be cleansed for 2,300 days. There's considerable debate about the 2,300 days. Are they literal 24-hour days, which would be like 6.5 years? In the apocryphal book of 1 Maccabees, the time of the cleansing is reported to be about 6.5 years. So that's a possibility. Do the days represent years? Because in chapter 9, a week is used as a year. So there's some precedent for that. But this is a belief that held by Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventist, and others that said that Jesus would return almost 200 years ago. So that's probably not going to hold water. For some of them, we're living in the millennium. I hope not. Are the evening and morning corresponding to the evening and morning sacrifices? In other words, in 2,300 literal days, we're going to have 1,150 evening sacrifices and 1,150 morning sacrifices. So it's only 1,150 years instead of, I mean, half of 6.5 years, 3.2 or 4 years. This generally seems to be too short, but it can be explained away if you put enough what if in there. So I prefer the literal days. But the thing to remember is that in spite of the fact that the sanctuary had been profaned, or in this case would be profaned, it was going to be cleansed. And as I said a little while ago, one of the things that we take from studies like this is that God's still in control. You know, we don't like what's going on in our country. There's no question about it. They did not like the fact that the sacrifices were taken away, that the sanctuary was profaned. But God said, oh, it's only for 2,300 days. He knew what the timetable was, even if Daniel didn't. And we know that eventually, after the tribulation, he's going to set up his kingdom. We don't know when the rapture is going to come, but it's going to come. And no matter how bad things look, it's going to be better. The church today is essentially profaned, but we will be cleansed. And you know what the amazing thing is? We're going to be presented blameless by Christ. 1 Corinthians 1:8, Colossians 1:22, 1 Thessalonians 5:23. As bad as things are, they're going to be better. One of the difficulties in determining the time frame comes from knowing which desolation Daniel is talking about in this, or the angels are talking about in this conversation. Because Daniel lists seven desolations. This is the first one in 8:13, where Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, or AE, and pictures the future beast and all the things that he does in the sanctuary. In 9:17, we read about the sanctuary at Daniel's time. In 9:18, we read about the land at Daniel's time. A few verses later, in 9:26, talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, which doesn't occur until A.D. 70, when it's destroyed by the Romans. And then in 9:27, the desolation has to do with the beast in the tribulation. 11:31, the same thing, and 12:11, the same thing. So of those seven desolations, which one are the angels talking about? And of course, there's a lot of debate. But we've read the first 14 verses describing the vision itself. The rest of the chapter we have the interpretation. So after our break, we'll start with verse 15. Father, thank you for the Lord Jesus. Thank you for the Holy Spirit, the one that led Daniel to write this. Open our hearts and minds to his leading this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.